Captain Featherstone Dilke, Reel 9. Now, we got to the point where you got back, and your next posting would be back to HMS Vernon yet again,
yep.
I think, from which you were from August 54 to July 55, on the training staff. I think as a lieutenant commander, by the way.
Yes, I was then a lieutenant commander.
I think you got that promotion a little earlier from looking at
yes,
at
I was a lieutenant commander August 50.
Did it make much of a difference, that next step in rank?
Not really, it was automatic, yeah.
Now, what were you doing this time at the Vernon?
At Vernon, I was in charge of all the training. There was a commander training, and I was the lieutenant commander training, but I did all the donkey work, as is so often the case. And in addition to the training side, I had to make arrangements for all the visits of VIPs or other courses of senior officers who came to visit Vernon.
Was there much to it? I mean, did you enjoy the posting? Or
oh, I enjoyed it a lot, yes. I think that it was a very, very good training organization there. It was during that time that, as I recounted earlier, we had this visit from the Shah of Persia. But it went on extremely well. I've mentioned that, I think, already.
Anything else about that time? Or?
Yes, the next thing about that time was that I got promoted to commander. I was sitting in my office on the 30th of June 1955 at about 11 o'clock when a member of the staff came in and said, "May I be the first to congratulate you on your brass hat?" And so I was absolutely thunderstruck. Anyway, I went off to the naval outfitters Gives to buy a brass hat and get another stripe sewn on my uniform. And that was it. So that was when I left Vernon, having joined it as a 2.5 and left it as a commander.
And your next thing, you see HMS President, September 55 to September 57, Staff of Royal Danish Naval. Now, what's the arrangement there?
Well, I was appointed to president because they provided my pay. But I was sent out there to advise as the Danish Navy's TAS officer, and to advise them on anything that was within my capability. There had been another officer before me who I never actually met, but I became a Dane for 2 years, and my wife and children went out there. And we became Danes.
So you're based at Copenhagen?
Copenhagen, yes. We had a nice house in Copenhagen. The offices were on the side of Copenhagen Harbour. My wife had to do all the shopping in Danish, which is a very difficult language. Although most of my work was reading papers in English. Although I had also papers in Danish, which I managed eventually to get more or less the gist. But most of the officers with whom I'd served, had done English courses. I mean, the fleet operations officer had done a long course in England, so had the signal officer, so had the gunnery officer. But they terribly appreciated if you at least made a try of speaking Danish, which is not so difficult to read. But unless you can pronounce it right, they won't understand. And it's not an easy language to learn.
But you did try.
We tried. Showed willing, I think, is the cry.
Now, what exactly were your duties then? Can you go through them?
Well, I was a full member of the Danish Admiral Staff and treated as such. In addition to advising on anti-submarine matters, or torpedo and anti-submarine matters. They also asked me frequently to advise on subjects quite outside my remit. You know, how to deal with matters of morale and officer-like qualities and so forth. And I used to lecture at their staff colleges and so on. But it was most agreeable, and I still keep up, even 50 years later, with my colleagues in the Danish Navy.
What did you think of the Danish Navy as a fighter?
Well, they had an immense respect and affection for the Royal Navy. That was the first thing that struck one. anything you said was sort of looked upon as gospel. They couldn't not be more pro-British. I never met anything other than the greatest of friendship, which is why I've kept up with them ever since. In fact, I've been back there. But I introduced them to various naval practices, and on going back there 40 years later and meeting those with whom I'd served, I was delighted to see that they still did the same sort of things as I'd recommended 40 years earlier.
What kind of things?
Well, I... ways of running things, way, you know, ideas, morale, relations between officers and men, lots of little things like that. Because they had this enormous respect for the Navy, the Royal Navy, which made my job all that much easier. But I used to go to sea with them, and one little incident which I'll never forget, the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh passed through Danish waters in the Britannia on their way for a state visit to Sweden. This, I should think, would be about 1950, 56, 57, something like that. And I was sent out in one of their destroyers, which was going to greet the Britannia and escort her through the Danish waters. I think we fired a salute and all that sort of things one does. And in fact, the admiral asked me to compose a signal which he could send to the Queen, welcoming her to Danish waters, which I duly did. Anyway, we came in from ahead in this destroyer, and we were meant to turn round 180 degrees and fire our salute. Unfortunately, just at the moment, after the captain had put the wheel over, some sailor down below sat on an alarm button, to the extent that the helmsman couldn't hear the orders from the bridge. And so we found ourselves heading straight for the bridge, straight for the Britannia, at 20 knots. Terrible panic. Anyway, we managed to eventually get the sailor off the alarm button and get the ship back to on course. But when the Queen, when we left the Queen, she made a nice signal saying how very smart the Danish ships had been, but didn't say how very well they'd been handled. I still have the copy of the signal in my scrapbook. Well, there was that.
Anything else? What sort of joint exercises would be done? I mean, they were members of NATO, weren't they?
They were members of NATO. Occasionally, British ships came over and exercised with them.
What were the exercises like? What were
they'd be sort of anti-air exercises and anti-submarine exercises. They had some of their own submarines, which were very, very efficiently run. They were British built, the Brits used to come over and held joint exercises with the Danes.
Were there any wider NATO exercises? You know, the whole at a larger scale.
On one occasion, the Danes sent a little squadron over to England. They sent a submarine and about three frigates or destroyers, I think. And I came over with them. Rather amusing. We were in Portland, but just before going out and doing some exercises, and we just arrived there, and the local admiral came on board. I was at that time talking to the captain of the Danish submarine in English. And the admiral came up to me and said, "What marvelous English I spoke," thinking I was a Dane. I didn't know how long I could hold on to this particular ploy. Because if I held on too long, he'd have run me in for impertinence, I think. But he failed to show, to see that I was wearing English medal ribbons, plenty of them. And I still thought I was a Dane. But there it was. I disabused him and said, "Yes, actually, I'm a Brit myself." But no, we had a very pleasant time, well received in Portland, and then sailed back again. But
anything else about your time with the Danish Navy then? That was coming to an end around about September 1957.
Yes, that's right, yeah. No, I reported, of course, to the British Admiral up in Oslo. The flag officer, whatever he's called, Admiral Gladstone in those days. And I used to go and see him from time to time and tell him privately about the state of the Danish Navy. I wasn't meant to, really, but he wanted me to.
What did he say? I mean, what was the gist of your report?
Well, he wanted to know what the sort of what the morale was like, what their efficiency was like, about the personalities in the Danish Navy. I was never compromised by my admiral, but my successor, alas, was compromised, and that caused one hell of a row. I was never bailed out, next admiral, who I won't mention, went and compromised my successor.
So the next thing then is Joint Services Staff College at Latimer.
That's right.
From January 58 to July 58, 6-7 months course.
Yeah, well, that is a Joint Service Staff College, as the title implies. Army, Navy, Air Force, Americans, Canadians, Australians, and a lot of very, very nice people. Many of whom went on to very important jobs. You had 6 months there, quite hard work.
Writing. Tell us, what was the nature of the course? Tell me exactly how it was worked.
You worked in syndicates, really.
Could you explain how the syndicates
The syndicate might consist of about eight officers. Of commander or captain's rank, of any sort of specialization, any sort of service, Army, Navy, Air Force, civil servant, and you were required to write papers on various subjects. I can't for the life of me remember what they were now. And they were then criticized by the directing staff, who tells you where you've gone wrong or how badly you'd expressed yourself, or whatever it was. You met a lot of very up-and-coming people that course, of all nationalities, all the old Commonwealths, apart from Americans.
It's a very high-status course.
It's a pretty high-status course, yes, it is indeed. It's one below the what used to be called the Imperial Defence Course, which is in London, the IDC. Which still goes, except it's called something else now, National Defence something.
And what exactly were you learning? The principles.
Well, you had a lot of lectures by important people, both on politics, on military matters, on economics, on law and order, and any lecturers you had down were at the top of the tree. I mean, you'd have somebody like the Commissioner of Police from London, who talk about policing, you'd have the Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, Supreme Allied Commander Europe. He'd come over and talk about NATO. Politico-military stuff, it really was. Absolutely complete cross-section of all the military arts. You carried out a number of visits to each other's services. We went to a fighter station, I remember.
You've got a story about that, haven't you?
Well, hardly a fair to tell it against the RAF, but it was in the days when we were scared of the Russians and thought they might bomb us any moment. And we used to keep a couple of, this particular air station, which is in East Anglia, a couple of fighters at instant readiness at the end of the runway. And we arrived there, and there, sure enough, were two Javelin all-weather fighters at the end of the runway. And we were told that we were going to be given a demonstration of their instant readiness. And they rigged up a loudspeaker on the airfield so we could hear what the control tower was saying to these people. And eventually the order came to scramble. And We expected to hear the whine and roar of these enormous engines. And in fact, all that happened was that two cockpit covers in these aircraft slid back, and the pilots put their hands out with their thumbs pointing downwards. And there was a certain amount of muttering from the RAF people with us, including the station commander. And anyway, some aircraft dashed forward and it tightened something up on the aircraft, or appeared to do so, and they tried again, but no joy. And so we also, I think it's about lunchtime, isn't it? And so we went in and had some lunch. And after lunch, we were asked whether any of us would like to go for a flight in the Javelin. And there were two seats available. I, being a fool, said, yes, I would. So I was asked if I got a cold, and I said, I've had one, I think it's okay now. So I was taken to the station doctor, who said, oh, yes, you're okay. And so I was dressed up in all the sort of paraphernalia which they put on pilots these days, and strapped into the back of this enormous Javelin aircraft, which carried the pilot in front and the passenger like me behind. And we took off with a roar and climbed like a rocket. And eventually I discovered that my oxygen mask was not working very well, and I was being starved of oxygen. So I rather indicated to the pilot that I think we better go back, which we did. And so we came in to land at this airfield and got a wave off at the last moment. And the pilot opened up the throttles, and we did a very, very tight turn indeed. So much as I blacked out, because I hadn't been provided with a G-suit like the pilot. Anyway, I came to when the wheels hit the runway, eventually, and it was a sharp lesson to me, you know, don't go and swank in front of the others, and especially not in front of the RAF, because they'll always get the last word.
Was it, I mean, cooperation, I mean, the whole thing was, it was a joint service.
Yeah.
Was cooperation built into everything on the course?
I mean, absolutely. Everything had to be very, very joint. And we took the Army and the Air Force out in an aircraft carrier and did all the things that aircraft carriers can do, you know, bombing and this and that, what have you, and landing. They were pretty well thrilled with that. And the Army took us to, I think, the School of Artillery at Lark Hill on Salisbury Plain and fired off all their guns for us and scared us stiff and drove us around in tanks and things like that.
And what was the point of these demonstrations? To show you what each other could do, or to make sure you worked closely? Or what was
the
point?
The idea was to get to know people of the other service, understand their problems, if any, and there sure are, and generally see they were decent chaps like you, and how easy it was to get on with them if you had the right attitude.
So it wasn't so much learning how you'd work together, it was learning that
how to cooperate together, and what each other's service problems were, really. And half the thing is knowing what your colleagues' problems are.
Anything else about Latimer?
No, it's a very gentlemanly existence.
Now, your next posting was to the Royal Naval Tactical School, Woolwich.
Woolwich, that's right, yeah.
And you were posted to the directing staff.
Yeah, I was one of the directors there.
And that was from September 58 to July 60.
Yep.
Now, what did this entail then? What was the role on the directing staff? You were one of the directing staff, but you weren't...
I was one of the directing staff, yeah.
And what were you doing?
There was one of every speciality, really. There was a naval aviator, a submariner, a gunnery officer. I was a torpedo and anti-submarine officer, a signals specialist, and navigation specialist, or navigation direction specialist. And we used to have to give lectures on our particular subject to both British and foreign and Commonwealth students. Quite a critical audience. You had to be able to answer a lot of intelligent questions. So you really had to know your subject. But we had a very, very live director, James Baldwin, who was a senior captain, became an admiral eventually. And he really made things hum. He set very, very high standards. And he was relieved by a former aviator, Captain Shaw. But no, it was a very high powered course, and I enjoyed it a lot. I had a house in London in Blackheath, and
was there much new that was coming into the world of TASS?
No, I didn't think so. I mean, Polaris hadn't arrived and things like that, or Trident or anything like that. No, we were still almost in Second World War weaponry, apart from aircraft, which of course had increased their performance immensely.
So the next thing would be in August 60. HMS Afrikander.
Well, that was the base ship in South Africa, where I went out as the fleet operations officer. And that was the biggest of the whole, all the naval stations. It stretched from halfway across the Indian Ocean on the eastern side to the west coast, 1,000 miles into the Pacific on the western side, and down to the Antarctic and up to the equator. So it was a pretty big beat. And we had to keep tabs on all naval matters in that area. I mean, we administered the ice patrol ship down in the Antarctic. We had a wireless station at Mauritius. I went up to the Independence celebrations in Nigeria, where again I had some other amusing experiences.
Would you want to tell us those? That's quite interesting.
Well, it was 1960, I think, the independence of Nigeria, and I went up there escorting the wife of the commander-in-chief, because the CNC was coming back from the West Indies, and they were all meet up in Lagos. And part of the celebrations in Lagos, there was one episode of the opening of the new palace of the Obas, O-B-A-S, who was sort of a local headman. And I went along with the captain of the Bermuda and the commodore commanding the Nigerian Navy, who was in fact an English commodore on loan to the Nigerians. And we sat in the sun, listening to all these speeches in foreign tongues. And eventually, at the end of it all, there was a great scrum of people trying to get out. And we saw a side door in the walled enclosure. We thought if we went through that and turned left and then left again, we'd find our official car and driver. And so we went through this door, and it shut behind us with a click, so we couldn't go back. And we found ourselves in a road rather like the Mall in London, but not quite so wide, but getting on for it, lined about 20 deep, as far as the eye could see, with Nigerians. So we formed up three abreast. The captain of Bermuda and I were very tall, and the commodore was rather short, and we put him in the middle, and we began to march down the center of the street in our full uniform. And all of a sudden, out of the crowd, there jumped two drummers, stark naked except for a leopard skin loincloth. And they took station ahead of us and began to beat their drums. And the crowd set up a chant of dance. So we looked at this commodore of ours and said, what are we to do? He said, I think we've got to dance. And so we set up a sort of slow pas de bar, they call it, followed behind these drummers. The crowd absolutely roared its approval. Eventually, thank God, the drummers melted into the crowd, and we recovered our dignity, saw a left turn, took it, another left turn, and there, thank God, was our car. But luckily, the Daily Mirror never saw it.
Now, HMS Afrikander, that wasn't actually a ship.
No, that was a shore establishment.
And that was where, sorry? Just
in Cape Town, or just outside Cape Town.
And what was like? So you were ashore most of the time?
Well, I used to go to sea in the ships from time to time. I mean, when I went up to Nigeria, I came back. I flew up there, and I came back in HMS Jaguar, I think it was. No, Lynx, HMS Lynx, which had been representing the UK up there. And we called in at Luanda, I think, on the way down. They caused a little row because I'd obtained diplomatic clearance for this visit to the Lynx. And we were very well received there. Of course, we were still Portuguese in those days. Eventually he got back to Cape Town, and we found that there had been a parliamentary question as to why HM government had approved a visit by one of Her Majesty's ships to such an unfriendly place. Anyway, Mr. Orr Ewing, who was then an MP, answered in a very robust way and knocked that one very smartly on the head. But
When you took passage on ships, was this part of your duties, or was that just for...
Just as a passenger, yeah.
Now, what exactly were you doing as TAS? You were TAS officer?
Yeah.
Fleet Operations Officer, TAS officer?
Well, I was Fleet Operations Officer mainly.
And what did that entail?
Well, it entailed keeping tabs on all the ships, all the Queen's ships, as I say, between the equator and the Antarctic, and between the South Atlantic and the middle of the Pacific. We didn't deal with the West Indies.
Now, how did you do that, though? I mean, you know, you had to monitor. Did you have a plot, or...?
Oh, yes. I had a big plot in my office, and I knew where every ship was, because every ship in the Navy, when it's on a foreign station like that, it sends its a position report at least once a day. So you can say, right, he was there. At that time, we know what course and speed he was doing. So 6 hours later, he's probably going to be there. But I mean, you may remember that when Tristan da Cunha blew up, that volcano it was. Well, I mean, I had to deal with all of that.
What did that entail with?
Well, it entailed getting what ships we could of ours down there to help and stand by. And we brought back a lot of the inhabitants. I think it was the Pua, which went down there. It's that sort of thing which you've got to, very short notice, you've got to scratch around and see what you can do to help.
You wouldn't go down yourself, you just...
Well, I was there, with a worldwide wireless set, and my admiral expected me to act first and report afterwards. You don't hang around.
Anything else about your time on, at Cape Town?
No, except, of course, it was the most wonderful job for me and marvellous for my wife and children. Because they both went to South African schools. And we had a very nice bungalow on the outskirts of Cape Town.
It was a comfortable lifestyle for you.
It was absolutely five-star, yes. Absolutely super.